mic instead so it's recorded for the podcast. Hi, welcome to Client-Side Code and Internationalization. It's a terribly exciting subject, deeply entertaining. I'm sure you're thinking to yourself, you know, after this, I'm going to be a better person after I know about this esoteric subject. I'm John Wiley, and I am a user experience designer at Google. So I design Google stuff. I'm a native Austinite, born and raised here in Austin, Texas. And I don't live here anymore. I live in Mountain View. But there is a Google office here if you want to stay in Austin and you like Austin, but you want to work for Google, we're hiring. There's comment cards probably being passed around, or if you got one, those are really helpful to South by Southwest, and they're helpful to the speakers to sort of understand how well they did or how well they didn't do and what topics were interesting and that sort of thing. So I encourage you to fill out the comment cards. Cool. So, welcome. Internationalization. Can I get a show of hands real quick? How many of you are working on web products that you are creating for two or more languages? My goodness. Why are you here? You know everything. Keep your hands raised. Three or more languages. Four or more. Five or more. 10 or more. 15 or more. 20 or more languages. The Googlers have their hands up in the back. Yeah. So, but that's pretty good. I mean, it was a lot of people out here working with languages, like 3, 4, or 5 languages. So that's pretty exciting. This isn't a disclaimer. I just want to set some expectations. In the book, it says advanced. this is going to be advanced. Yeah, it's as advanced as it can be in an hour, right? I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a high level type thing. So, and also it means that I'm making some assumptions here. I'm making some assumptions about your knowledge, some assumptions that I don't have to preach about, you know, separation of presentation and markup and content, things like that, that you've all, you know, consumed the Kool-Aid on CSS layouts and best practices and, you know, semantic markup and all that other stuff. If you haven't, then we can talk later. So, fantastic. So, some of the Googlers in the back there, they had their hands up. I kept saying 20 languages. I could have kept going. I could have said 50 languages. I could have said 60 languages. I could have said 100 languages. Google search is localized in 117 different languages. And, it's 117 if you count Bork, 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 Swedish Chef, Google. I'm feeling lucky. Or if you count Elmer Fudd, I'm feeling lucky. That's a language. Hacker, so Leet Speak. We have a Leet Speak search engine if you want to go search in that and be totally Leet. We also have Klingon. I don't speak Klingon. Does anyone here in the room speak Klingon? Who's willing to admit it? No? Well, I know you're out there. So Klingon search. Help the Klingons find things. Pig Latin. Igpe Atenle. Urchse the Ebwe. Although, I don't know why desktop isn't. Desktop day. What? I guess we have a localization problem there. So 117 languages. So why would we do that? Why would we go to the effort of, and granted, search is a fairly simple product, but in terms of the UI for the most part, but why would we go to the trouble of localizing our content into and our interface into 117 plus or minus some fake languages? It has to go back to Google's mission to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And of course, that's it's the universal part of that, right? We want to organize information and make it accessible to as many people as we possibly can. And we work really hard to do that. It's a hard problem to solve. Getting to 117 languages is hard, even for a search engine, which doesn't have a lot of UI content. So that's why we do it. Clearly, lots of you are already doing this. You're localizing your products in multiple languages, so you understand the benefits of getting your content out there and broadening your market, getting more reach. I don't know what this says, by the way. So I apologize if it says something odd. When I think of internationalization, I think of, you know, far off exotic places, places that maybe I haven't been to before. And before I travel to a new and an interesting place, I want to learn as much as I can about that place, right? I'm going to go get some travel guides. I'm going to read some books. I might go, you know, do a web search and look at all that stuff. And I might try to pick up some of the language as well, right? I want to learn the lingo, you know, what are the words that I need to get by during my travels? And I also want to get a sense of the lay of the land, right? What's interesting out there? What are the customs? What things do I need to watch out for? Precautions I need to take? What do I need to look out for? All that kind of stuff. And that's kind of what this presentation is about in terms of internationalization. For many of us, internationalizing our sites and pushing them out there into lots of different languages, that can be a journey to a new, exciting world of localized content. And we need to explore the language a little bit in this space and find out, you know, what's going to trip us up. But just like traveling to a new place, you never really know what that place is going to be like until you actually get there. So working through the challenges of localizing your content and internationalizing your site, that's something ultimately you're going to have to do yourself. And as I said, clearly many of you are doing that. But we need more trip reports from this space. There's not a lot of content, there's not a lot of information out there about going through this process, particularly when it comes to how browsers behave in this environment. I'll talk a little bit about that later. You might see the monkey gland chutney on the Holiday Inn menu here, right in the middle. That was something that kind of scared the crap out of me when I was in Tanzania. We'll be back to that slide later on. So a little bit of jargon. I'm going to talk about the Asians. Internationalization, or internationalization, if you prefer. Localization, which I've been mentioning, translation, globalization, punctuation, documentation, validation, verification, after which you'll need a vacation. So, does internationalization equal translation? Not hypothetical. Yes, no, maybe. Yes, no, I don't know, could be. What's the answer? Tell us. I don't think so. I think it's a big no. And we'll talk a little bit about why in a moment. I'm going to define what I think internationalization is. So, or actually what the W3C thinks it is, which I happen to agree with. Internationalization is the design and development of a product, application, or document, content that enables easy localization for target audiences that vary in culture, region, or language. So that's the definition that the W3C has for internationalization. And the important part here is that it's the design of a product, right? You're enabling your product for localization. So this whole process of building out your product and thinking ahead about how your product's going to work in multiple languages, that's a process of internationalization. And a shorthand for internationalization is I18N, just because it's long to write, so they cut out the 18 characters in the middle and just drop in 18 in the middle, I18N. So that's actually a good shorthand. If you want to learn more about this, Google it. You can just search for I18N, and it'll pick up a lot of information distributed widely across the net. Localization refers to the adaptation of a product, application, or document content to meet the language, cultural, and other requirements of a specific target market. So localization is actually the act of taking your product, which hopefully you've successfully internationalized. It's capable of doing this. And you localize your product and turn it into, you know, what's appropriate for that target market. So this is not just language, right? It could be cultural things. It could be the requirements of that particular market. So it's all the things that you do to make your product fit and work and have the experience be great for that target market. So that's what localization is. L10N, the L is capitalized just to differentiate it from the I and internationalization. Not like the 18 wouldn't help, but globalization. I've heard this term used in this context before. It's a bit synonymous with internationalization and localization. And a lot of times you'll hear the internationalization term thrown around as well as a catch-all, but I like to be a little bit specific about them. I try not to use globalization just because it has so many other contexts in other spaces and economics and environmentalism and all that sort of stuff. So I try to avoid that word, but you'll see that word sometimes. Translation, you know, taking something from one language into another, translating it, changing it, you know, and making so that the meaning exists in that other language, which is different from transliteration, right? Or what's commonly called or referred to as transliteration, where you take content and you sort of translate it word for word, right? You don't change anything. You just take the exact word. But that loses a lot of the nuance of the language, right? So we try to avoid transliteration. Machine translation does a lot of that. So localization is more than just translation. On that previous slide, I said internationalization, but localization, it's more than just translation. It involves a lot of things. It's a great deal more than just changing the text and putting it into a new language. For one thing, it can involve local content, right? Content that's appropriate for the United States may not be appropriate for viewers in China. Legal compliance. So there might be a number of laws in other countries in which you have to comply with that your content you don't want to run afoul of those laws. Marketing. So persuading people to use your product or think about your product in interesting ways may be very culturally dependent and market-driven by the country. Keyboards. Some languages have crazy keyboard layouts, and some languages are hard to type in. We have Google Suggest on China, in Google China, because typing Chinese characters can be difficult for people. So Google Suggest offers an alternative to that, suggests some query refinements that people can use. Currency formats. There's a ton of ways to format currency and currency symbols, and it's very esoteric, and there's a ton of stuff about this, but there's currency formats, that's one localization. Back to this slide. So this is how they display Tanzanian shillings. They actually don't show a symbol for it. They just say TSHS. Date format, same thing. Year, month, day, month, you know, whatever. Cultural appropriateness. So it's not just about taking the exact website, right, and switching it over, and even changing the content, right? There might be some cultural issues at stake. Is red an angry color, or is it good luck, right? So for all of that, we won't be getting into any of that. Because this is going to be a very narrow focus. Localization of pages is a huge, huge topic. We've only got 1 hour, so we're not going to get into any of those other issues about localization. We're going to focus pretty much on markup. What happens in the browser, and how can we get the browser to do what we want it to do? So we'll talk about character encodings. A character encoding is basically a system that pairs any given character or symbol with a series of numbers so that computers can better understand, oh, when you say that character, you mean this, right? When you say this number, you mean this character. It's basically an ID system, a database for symbols. In the beginning, there was ASCII, and it was good. As long as your language used these characters, this character set. Not much there. It pretty much cuts out a ton of languages. A bunch. That's a scientific number. So they kind of, you know, we had ASCII for a long time, and then there were other character encodings. A lot of other stuff came along. We had ISO Latin. There's a bunch of Windows. There's dozens and dozens of character encodings out there. Then finally, somebody looked at all this, smart standards people, looked at all this and said, you know what, this is stupid. Let's just have one character encoding to rule them all and in the darkness bind them. So they came up with this last one here, which is Unicode. By the way, ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. The ISCII there is for Indic languages. It's for Indian. So Unicode. Unicode is this brilliant idea. They're going to say, well, we're going to take all of these character sets, all these crazy symbols, all this stuff that belongs to a variety of scripts and languages. We're going to map it all to some numbers, and we're going to put it all together. That way, boom, Unicode support, you get all of them. So this is a bunch of Unicode characters here. You might recognize some of these. Just some basic symbols. So Unicode includes lots of symbols for like building charts and drawing things and copyright symbols and trademark symbols and that kind of stuff. Mathematical symbols, Greek, I think that's simplified Chinese, I'm not sure, Japanese, down at the bottom. So all of these symbols exist within the Unicode character set. Specifically, we want to use UTF-8. UTF-8, there's other variants of Unicode. There's UTF-16, UTF-32. UTF-8 is the 8-bit Unicode. It's a UTF stands for Unicode Transformation Format. So why would we use UTF-8 as opposed to UTF-16 or UTF-32? Those are bigger numbers. Aren't they better? Well, UTF-8 is compatible with legacy ASCII content. So there's a ton of content out there in the world that is originally encoded in the ASCII character encoding. And the great thing about Unicode 8 or UTF-8 is it's directly compatible. So the code points for UTF-8 map directly to the code points for ASCII. So ASCII is kind of a subset at that point of UTF-8. So it makes it really easy to just bring content from legacy databases or what have you and just pop it right in and say, hey, I'm UTF-8, right? If it's your standard ASCII encoding. Modern operating systems support UTF-8, which is good. Be careful because not all fonts have all of the Unicode characters. In fact, I don't know of a font that has all of the Unicode characters. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of Unicode characters, so that's not necessarily a big deal. But test your content. You know, that's just the bottom line. Make sure you test it cross-browser, cross-platform. The fonts that you're using in your CSS, make sure you're specifying fonts that actually have the symbols that you're using in your Unicode content. Modern browsers support it. That's good. That's what we're talking about. It has all the characters you need, or you'd ever need, pretty much. It's really great because you can present a mix of scripts at once. So if you have a document for a multilingual audience, say English and Russian, English uses a Latin script and Russian uses a Cyrillic script. And at some point in the past, you may have had to use a character encoding that it would be really hard to do, right? Because you'd have a Latin character encoding, then you'd have to have a Cyrillic character encoding, and it got really messy. Well, Unicode's great because it includes all those letters. So you can just say, well, it's UTF-8, done. Now I can put Cyrillic and English in my document. This one's pretty important to Google, at least, and hopefully it's important to everybody. It's smaller than UTF-8-16 for most content. So each of the characters are encoded X number of bytes, right? Might be 1 byte, might be 4 bytes, something like that. But the vast majority of characters that we use in Latin script, Romance languages, and most of the other codes, they use fewer bytes in UTF-8 than they do in UTF-16. So you're actually going to end up saving some bytes on the transmission if you're in UTF-8. The exception might be your CJK languages, which is Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. Those symbols and those characters tend to use a few more bytes in UTF-8 than they do in UTF-16, but that's made up for the fact that the punctuation and the spaces, they're still ASCII, right? So it kind of evens out, assuming you actually use punctuation in your CJK content. No need for character escapes. So as web designers and developers, I think we've got this habit, right, where we type ampersand %169 for a copyright symbol. Or more commonly, we'll use an HTML entity for this purpose, which is actually just mapped to this. And that would be ampersand the word copy and semicolon. Well, we don't have to do that. If it's in UTF-8, you can save a bunch of bytes. Just use the copyright symbol. It's like any other character. You don't have to have character escapes, right? So, well, except for a couple. There's a few character escapes that you'll want to keep. When you need markup characters, so a less than sign, a greater than sign, or an ampersand, which is reserved for the escape sequence, you'll want to encode those as %LT. That's an HTML entity. It's not the actual character escape sequence, but it's fewer bytes. It's just two characters. So you can use the less than and the greater than, and of course the ampersand. You don't really have to use the greater than symbol because browsers are actually just looking for the less than when they're trying to parse out the opening tag for a piece for any element of markup, they're just looking for the less than symbol. So you can actually get away with just dropping the greater than symbol in there most of the time. Let's see. Ah, hard to see characters. Non-breaking space. But you can see them, but you can't distinguish them from other spaces unless you have some special editor. So non-breaking space, that might be a point where you want to use an escape or an HTML entity. Although that's kind of a presentational markup type thing. You might be able to handle that with CSS, no wrap, word wraps, that kind of stuff. So, hello, come on. Yeah. So what we want to do for our character encoding is we need to tell the browser, right? We need to say, hey, browser, this is the character encoding I'm using. So there's a couple of ways of doing that. We say we can use the HTTP response header that you send from Apache. Now we're getting into server side, but this is, you know, stay with me here. Content type, text HTML, character set. So what this is doing is basically saying, hey, I'm a MIME type of text HTML, my HTML document, and my character set is UTF-8. So this is on the server side. This is probably the best place to do it. Another way to do it is the meta element actually in the document header. Meta has an HTTP equivalent type, which you can say content type of this. External CSS files also have another property. CSS files, you can set charset UTF-8 for character encoding for your CSS. Browsers give priority to the HTTP header in this. So even if you had a different character encoding specified in your meta element in the head, it's going to listen to the server before it listens to the head, even though it comes second in the source or the process. Also, it's actually best to use both the header and the meta for HTML. And that's just in case the document gets saved somewhere. At that point, the browser still knows the character encoding and it can process it correctly. Browsers will also try to guess at the character encoding, but why make them parse through the whole document and try to figure out what the character encoding is? Just tell them up front. If you want to save some bytes, just use the HTTP header. It's not really necessary to use the meta. So that's character encoding. Now we want to talk about language. We want to find content in the right language, right? We need to be able to specify the language for our content so that search engines, for instance, can look for content in a specific language. Now, search engines don't just use, you know, they don't just do what you tell them, right? They'll look at the content and say, is this really this language? But it really helps to be able to find content in the language. So if you're doing a search and you say, I only want to get results in Spanish, it really helps to be able to say, this content is in Spanish. You want to serve content in the right language. And there's a couple of reasons for this. It's beneficial for anything that will process your content based on language. So, for instance, screen readers. Some screen readers, the good ones, if you present a document and it doesn't know what language it's in, it's probably going to pronounce it in the default language of the screen reader, which, I mean, could be English. It's whatever it's defaulting to in the operating system. But if you tell the screen reader that your content is actually served in Spanish, it will try to pronunciate the words as if it's in Spanish. Machine translation systems, again, we'll talk about machine translation in a little bit, but it helps for the machine translators to know what language the content is in to begin with. Again, good machine translation systems will just analyze the content and say, that looks like English, but help them out, tell them what it is. Specifying the language says nothing about character encoding or direction. So declaring a language has no impact on which script will be used in your page and which direction that text will be rendered. These things are independent. And the reason for this is that some languages, a single language could use multiple scripts for the language, and it might also have multiple directions. So it really depends on the audience. So that's why we set these things separately. We'll talk about direction in a little bit. So we got to tell the browser. The way to tell the browser is through the attributes on the HTML element. Lang and XML lang attribute on the HTML element. And here it's just using the same attribute value. By the way, these attribute values, right here it says English. These can take multiple values, and it can get kind of long. The standard for it is like what's the base language, and then it has some like different bits for region and dialects and all kinds of other stuff. It's usually best to stick at the highest level you can unless you're very certain that your content is certainly being targeted at a very narrow sort of language segment. right? It's just easier just to call it English. Another way of doing this is character encoding is a meta element in the document header. Same thing, content language, you just say content N, and of course that leaves us with the actual HTTP response header. This first one up here, using the attributes, the language and XML, that's really the best way to go. And the reason for that is that many browsers actually have poor support for these other two methods. They sometimes get a little tripped up, or they don't pay attention to it, or they ignore it, or whatever. So it's better just to use the HTML attributes, because those are pretty well supported. It's also consistent with if we were to change the language of something within the document, we would have to use attributes for that. I'll talk about that in a second. I know it seems redundant to use the ling attribute and then follow it up with another attribute that says the exact same thing. You don't have to use both of those attributes. The first one is for HTML documents. The second one is for XHTML documents. XHTML typically gets served, MIME type, text, HTML. Browsers just treat it as tag soup to begin with. So if you think your markup is going to get treated as XML, throw that in. But if not, save a few bytes. So direction. How am I doing on time? Let's see. Wow. Blazing through this. So some jargon about direction. LTR, you'll see this all over the web in these documents, left to right text. English script, Latin script, is typically a left to right language. RTL, the opposite. Hebrew and Arabic being the well-known examples of scripts that are right to left. And then there's bidirectional text. This is document and content in which you've got multiple directions going on at the same time. Usually this is a multilingual page where you've got maybe both Hebrew and English in the same document. Hebrew and Arabic in and of themselves are somewhat bidirectional. To begin with, simply because numerals actually go from left to right in those languages as well. So this is where you get a mixture of directions, and it's really trippy. I'll show you that in a little while. By the way, text direction, as I was alluding to before, text direction should not be confused with language. Some languages use scripts that can go in either direction. There's a language called Azeri, which is spoken in Azerbaijan and I think in Iran. And occasionally, their scripts will go in either direction. I don't know if many of you are translating your content into Azeri, but if you are, important to know. So when I first was thinking about this, the right to left, I was thinking, well, how does this render in the source code? Is it literally like right to left in the source code? How does that work? And it's interesting. It uses the bidirectional algorithm. The bidirectional algorithm says that this content, these letter forms, the characters, will be in logical order in the source. So if you think about Hebrew, the first character and the first word of the first sentence is also going to be first in the source. It's going to be first in the computer's memory. This is logical order. So as you proceed through these characters, it's going to go ba 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 as you would expect, right? It's a logical order of this. There used to be, prior to Unicode and some bidirectional algorithms, there used to be visual Hebrew. And the way visual Hebrew worked was they would write the letters backwards. The sentence would be backwards. It'd be mirror image of the sentence. And then they would align it to the right of the page. So in the code, if you're writing source code for this, the very first character would be the last character in the sentence. And you just write it backwards. Da, 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 da. And as you can imagine, this is hard to format. Text wrapping becomes a pain because how do you know where the end of the sentence is, where the line break is. You don't. You have to just build that into the visual layout. This didn't really happen with Arabic so much. Arabic has character forms that are a little bit more cursive, and so when they were building software and system to support Arabic, they looked at it and they said, well, that's stupid. We're not going to do that. But in the early days, that's how they did some Hebrew. So there's still some content out there in the world. If you're trying to organize information, this is something you have to deal with. That uses visual Hebrew. So literally, if you're doing a search in Hebrew for something, you may have to look for backwards text. It's kind of annoying. Scripts have a default direction. So Latin script has a default direction. Those characters in Unicode have a default direction, and that is left to right. Hebrew characters have a default direction. That default direction is right to left. So you don't have to sit there and specify all day long, oh, well, I'm going to make this one right to left. I'm going to make this one left to right. Blah, 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 blah. You know, you don't have to do that. It's inherent in the system. And that's called strongly typed. Not to be confused with typing in programming languages, but it's called strongly typed as left to right or right to left. Come on, Keynote. Markup is left to right by default. It's supposed to be. It's hard to edit bidirectional markup unless your editor really recognizes markup as being markup. It understands this is actually markup and not just content. Bidirectional editors, if they recognize markup, they'll understand that it's left to right by default, and they won't try to apply bidirectional algorithms to your markup. Otherwise, you get weird things with, if you had a, less than slash p, greater than, right? It would switch those around, which you don't want to have happen. This is hard to do. There's not a lot of text editors and markup editors that actually support bidirectional content. Perfectly well. So it's just something you got to deal with. As I alluded to earlier, numbers are left to right by default. Spaces and punctuation are neutral. They do not have any inherent directionality. They inherit the direction from the surrounding strongly typed characters. So if you have punctuation, for instance, a space, in between two characters and a word that are right to left oriented, the space will take on the direction of the words around them. So you don't have to worry about, this word and this word and this word. You string them all together with the punctuation and the spaces, it's all going to turn out fine. The exception is if you're between two different types. So say you have an English sentence and then it's followed by some Arabic words inside of it and it's got commas. If that comma is in between an English word and an Arabic word, it's not going to think about what's next to it. It's going to inherit from the parent. So what it's going to do is going to say, what is the context of the direction I'm in? So it's going to look to the parent container, which is usually the HTML document. If the HTML document is LTR, it's going to be an LTR comma. The way to get around this is that you essentially just declare directionality around these things. So you might wrap it in a span and declare directionality. How do we declare directionality? We use a dir attribute. In HTML, so we have a language attribute from earlier, and then we say dir RTL. So what we're saying here is that this document is going to be right to left. Now, you can actually do this on any document. Just go to any website, open up Firebug, add an attribute, put dir equals RTL, and watch the whole thing go flip to the other side. It may not be very graceful. That's something we'll talk about in a second. You can also set directionality and language on individual elements. So this is getting back to this problem of how do you handle punctuation if there's mixed directionality going on. You just wrap that in a span, usually, and say, hey, this bit here, all of these things, it's right to left. And you only use this attribute when you want to change something, right, within the document. You're either declaring at the beginning, this is what I am, but if you use it again, what you're doing is you're just switching the context. There's also a CSS property for direction, but I encourage you not to use it. The CSS, for one thing, browsers defer to the markup here in this case. If there's an attribute saying right to left, it's going to ignore the CSS property. Markup is better than CSS because directionality is not a purely visual aspect of the content. Directionality is it's more than purely visual. It's structural to the content, to the document, to the language. There are also Unicode characters, control characters, that actually do this for you, that you can embed in your content that will switch the directionality of your content. I don't recommend using them because you can't see them. Unless you've got some totally fancy bidirectional editor with invisibles turned on that says this is a Unicode control point, control character. But they exist. Yay, standards. So this is the one that gets people in trouble a lot when they're switching and they're moving their content from one language to another, particularly English, is text expansion. English is a compact language, typically, compared to other languages. Now, your CJK languages can be smaller than English, but compared to a lot of other languages in the world, English is fairly compact. Small words in English can expand as much as 200 to 300% when translated into other languages. So think about that. Small words, where do we use small words? In tabs and navigation and menu systems and controls and things with icons on them and little buttons and stuff like that. Places that we're usually constrained in terms of space, right? And you want to think about these things when you're designing your page. You want to make it as bulletproof as you can, because if you don't, then you're going to end up something giant that's breaking out and it's falling out of its borders and all this stuff, and it's just ugly and horrible. And I can attest that if you don't think about these things beforehand when you're actually creating your layout and architecting your CSS, it's going to be really painful when you try to move to something that is translated into another language. Rule of thumb, though, plus 40%. That'll get you by. The variation varies depending on the number of characters in a word. So small words tend to blow up really big. Medium-sized words, not as much. It's like a paragraph in English isn't going to be much bigger as a paragraph in Italian, that sort of thing. But basically, 40% is kind of the guiding rule. Some languages eliminate spaces. Anybody speak German? Oh, yes, sprechen Sie Deutsch. German has a few compound nouns, so it'll eliminate spaces in words. This means it won't wrap. So you just get this very long word. So what do? You have to figure that out. So you get some text wrapping problems. You have to make some decisions about how you're going to support that. Some scripts happen to have wider characters than other scripts. Japanese tends to have wider characters than Latin scripts. Some scripts require greater line height. So Thai, for instance, has many diacriticals and little lines going up and down and that sort of stuff. So you may have a line height issue. Now, for all of these languages, typically what you'll end up doing is you'll create an external style sheet that's particular to the language that you can just load when you load for that particular locale. So an example of this is also Arabic. Arabic at the default browser font size that we compare. So usually default browser font size is 16 pixels. That's big. Most people reset their font size and bring it back a little bit, usually around 13 pixels, 12 pixels, that kind of thing. Well, at that size, by the way, don't use pixels, use M's or percentages or whatever. At that size, Arabic actually gets really, really small and hard to see. So for Arabic, you may go back in and say, well, we're going to bump up the font size a little bit. Watch out for abbreviations. English, we love abbreviations. We abbreviate all kinds of words, but abbreviations are actually not common in a lot of other languages. So when you abbreviate something, it's like, oh, I got plenty of room for that. No problem. But when you translate it, they're not going to put abbreviations into it. So be on the lookout for those. I tend to avoid abbreviations anyway, just as a general rule. Just have the whole word. Oh, except for this slide. So there's some tools out there that can help you get a rough idea about how this is going to work and how your site's going to look if you take it and you put it into other languages. One is the Google Translation Service. It's translate.google.com. It does lots of stuff. But it's a machine translator. So basically what it's doing is it's scraping the content, looking at the HTML, translating all the phrases, and rewriting that back out to a page. This is a quick check for text expansion, right? This is not a substitute for good QA and good translation and getting out there and really, doing due diligence. It's just a quick check to make sure that your CSS layout isn't going to totally explode. So don't use it for production. There are occasionally people who have taken their websites and run it through a translation service, a machine translator like Google Translate, and launched that as a product to users in countries that do not speak their language. And the results typically are comical. And because the translation service is not meant to do this, right? It's meant to, you know, to give you insight into a product that isn't localized, right? To give you a little bit of a hint as to what they're talking about. But if you take this and you translate it using machine translation and you push it out to people, they're going to think you don't care about them very much because it's not going to make any sense. And they're going to know that it was machine translated. And they're going to say, well, they don't care enough about our market. So it's actually going to be very damaging to your brand if you were to use a machine translation. Until machine translation is really good. So I'm gonna flip over here to, hopefully, Firefox. Yeah. So this is IKEA. IKEA is a good site to test this on because they have a nice liquid expanding layout. Here, let's bump it up a little bit. Yeah. So IKEA is fun. It doesn't break. And let's see if I can find my mouse here. Mouse, there it is. So this is IKEA translated, the exact same site, the US site, translated it into Russian using Google Translate. It holds up pretty well. Nothing really seems to be broken. I'll go back to this other tab. It looks pretty good. By the way, this is the actual Russian site for IKEA. So you can just run those through, compare them, see how it works. Whoops, wrong one. Get to that one in a second. Cool. It's going to make me go through my little animation again. Another tool that you can use is CSS Janus. And this is a really cool tool. And it was launched last week, and it was created at Google. It was created by Lindsay Simon, who's there. So you can talk to him about it if you're curious. Lindsay, if I screw this up, let me know. So it's a script for flipping CSS-based layouts. I'm being specific about CSS-based layouts here because it's table-based layouts. Don't have this problem. If you take a table-based layout, generally, and you put dir equals rt, right to rtl at the top of the document, browsers will actually take the table and take all the columns and go flip and mirror it. And they'll take all the content and they'll right-align it and they'll do all kinds of fun stuff with it. So table-based layouts actually flip this way, but we all know you probably shouldn't be using table-based layouts. CSS doesn't have this function. There's not an rtl function in CSS to say, hey, now do everything that you did in your CSS layout and turn it into something that will look good in a right-to-left environment. So Lindsay created this script that does it for you. And it's not a total solution, right? None of this is a total solution. It's not a panacea. It's not a silver bullet. These are things that are going to get you started. It's going to get you going in the right direction. It's going to set you on the right path. The web address is csjanus@commoner.com. And I'll flip back to, let's see, back here, and go look at it. And this is the CSS Janus page. And it's pretty cool. It's kind of cutting off there, but basically what it does is you can paste in your CSS or you can point it at a file, and it's got a couple flags on there just to make sure that it's doing what you want it to do. We'll try this example here. So if you look at this example, I don't know if, let's see, can everybody see that? Is it kind of small? This is probably going to go crazy, but let me try. All right, cool. And yeah, it's still cutting off. But so we have some interesting examples here. It's a class name should not change left and right. You wouldn't want something like this changing your class names on you, right? You're just changing the CSS. So if you have the actual words left and right in your class name, your IDs and stuff, you don't want to flip those things. That would suck. Padding. Got some padding on something. We have margin, background position, some other stuff. Our URL here. So again, we may have an image that's named that has words like left and right in the URL and stuff. And we might think about whether or not we want to try that. It says try me with flags. So You might have created a background image specifically for right-to-left environments, and you may have named it as such. You may have actually just swifted around, you know, clear left, left, and turn those into right. There's a flag for this if you want to change that into right. Cursor, NE resize. I had no idea that this CSS property existed. This is changing your cursor when you want to resize a box or something like that, and it points in a certain direction. Well, in right-to-left environments, so in left-to-right environments, it points to the northeast, right? But in right-to-left, it's going to flip. So that's actually going to get changed to northwest. No flip, some things you might want to say in there. It's like, don't flip this, because you don't always want to flip everything. So if we try this example, where'd it go? Results will appear here. Oh, come on, wireless. Submit. Oh, it doesn't happen automatically. I'm used to Ajax. Run. Clicking on stuff should just do it automatically, right?
Let me bring this out.
Oh, come on. Come on, wireless. Come on. Well, whatever. While it's looking up CSS Janus. So what would have happened there is, things like left and right will get switched out as appropriate. That padding and that mark, like the padding up there that goes around, so you've got all this padding on the left. So on the left, you've got 4 pixels. You want that padding on the right. So it's actually going to switch those around so that the padding's in the appropriate place. And it does some other cool stuff. So play around with that. It's a lot of fun. And if you have questions about it, just ask Lindsay. He's right here. So fantastic. Back through the animation. Da, da, da. JavaScript. So there's not a lot to say here about JavaScript, and I hate to disappoint you. You could talk a little bit about string concatenation and how you manipulate strings in the UI. These are sort of some general principles about internationalization and string manipulation. So one of the things that happens is we typically end up writing like a sentence, right? And we might want to replace a string in the middle of that with some variable. The problem is we tend to do it in a way that is English-centric. So you just have to be careful about those things. And this might be a little bit of a cop-out, but really, the JavaScript stuff really falls under the realm of programming languages. So how do you internationalize programming languages and programming language content, right? JavaScript is pretty much a programming language, so it follows along those things. So I had an hour, and I was like, well, there's not a lot to say about this. So you generally want to follow the best practices of server-side internationalization when dealing with JavaScript. There is an issue you will run into, and that's alert boxes in Firefox. So pray that this works. Back to Firefox. JavaScript alert test. There's a couple of things being illustrated in this page. One is this issue about where the punctuation goes when you're dealing with something that seems like it's left to right, but is really right to left. This page has a DIR attribute at the top of it that's saying it's right to left content, but it's using Latin script, which is rendered left to right, but the punctuation is in the front. So I'll show you. So, So it's that exclamation point is there at the end after the T. Click for an alert, but when it renders, it actually renders over there on the other side, and that's because of those bidirectional rules. It's inheriting from its parent. So this is a right to left document. If it was written in Arabic, it would make total sense. It wouldn't make total sense unless you understood Arabic. But it would be left. It'd be right aligned. So if I go over here and I click for an alert, hello world, not right aligned. And this may or may not be what you expect. A lot of times it's what you don't expect. And this may have to do with how Internet Explorer behaves. When Internet Explorer sees DIR RTL as an attribute on the document, it actually flips the UI. So it will put the scroll bar on the left-hand side of the window. And it seems like that might be what you want to happen, have happen. But the problem is that sometimes your end user actually wants the browser to inherit its directionality from the operating system and not pay attention to what the document content is doing. Like the document content can be rendered, you know, in a right-to-left context, but they might actually want and prefer to have the user interface itself, the scroll bars and all that sort of stuff, adhere to what the operating system is, which might be a left-to-right context. So you can argue about whether IE is doing the right thing in this case. Firefox is basically not doing that. It's saying, well, you're in a left-to-right UI operating system, so I'm not going to... This is an operating system dialog in a way. It's a JavaScript alert. It's built into the browser. So it's actually not going to render it left-to-right.
Okay. Actually, while I'm out here, I want to show you something else. That's Gmail in Hebrew. That's hard to do. The emails are in English. Note the dates as well, localized date formats. You can do this in your own Gmail if you use Gmail. You just go to the settings and change the language, and it'll change it to whatever language you want. Arabic is pretty interesting as well. Changing it back's kind of tricky. You have to remember where the buttons are or have another tab open with the, you know, English version. But it's kind of fun. This is Google in Arabic. I want to show you something kind of trippy, if I can do this without going crazy all the way over there. So this is where we get into the bidirectional algorithm. You start selecting bidirectional text. That's the beginning of the text. So we start going around, and it's selecting, and it's selecting, and it's selecting, and whoa. Zoom in on that. Whoa. That is crazy. It selected from the beginning, and it followed along, and it continued, and then it switched direction and continued to the end. And if I had another RTL string out here, it would have flipped back to the beginning of that string and continued on its merry way. This is why editing bidirectional content is hard, because you might do a select to do something and it goes blah, 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 and it gets really complicated. So, all right, back to Keynote. How much time do I have? 7 minutes. Awesome. Browser bugs. There's a bunch of them. They're often obscure. There's a bunch. They're often obscure. They're particular. So CSS that worked perfectly fine in left-to-right context may break in right-to-left context. So your favorite totally awesome browser that's crazy standards compliant and understands CSS 2.1 to the nth degree, flip that sucker into RTL and see what happens. Language is a barrier. There are intelligent web developers that are designing content and solving these bugs. They don't speak English. They speak Arabic and Hebrew. They're documenting these things and they're writing about them, but it's hard to get to it. It's hard to see it. We need a bidirectional acid test. Acid test doesn't really test for these things very well. It does a little bit, but not great. I think every acid test that we do, we really ought to have a right-to-left one, just to make sure that, you know, it works in both contexts. A couple of bugs. By the way, I'm just showing a couple of bugs because they're legion, and you'll find them. You're just going to get out there, and you're going to find them, and you're going to figure them out. And when you do, email me and let me know what happened. So IE direction bug, IE sometimes doesn't pay attention to the direction attribute in the documentation, so it
it goes all haywire. This is pretty easily solved. Put zoom 1 on the parent, give it has layout, problem solved. Everything that's over there on line 1, line 3, and line 6, which is actually supposed to be on the left, they'll line up. I'll show you that in a second. Inline padding bug. Firefox, Internet Explorer, not Safari. So this is a unordered list, and it's got display inline on it. You'll see the left to right one at the top, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, perfectly fine. The next one, same order. Oop, no, not same order. If it's in a right-to-left context, it really should begin with alpha on the right. It doesn't. It gets wrong. There's padding in there. It's getting rid of the padding. Firefox and IE do crazy things with padding in right-to-left. For inline elements, it's actually collapsed all the padding and put it in front of the element. So the only way to solve this is to float it. I'm kind of running out of time here, so you have to trust me. But instead of doing inline, you have to put float on it, which is really annoying because then you have to clear floats and all that other stuff. So it's kind of a pain. By the way, that's how it's supposed to look in IE when you put zoom 1 on it. Cool. There's that. And I think I've left a minute for questions. Janice? Yeah, what? Oh, is it done? Sweet. Come on, Janice. Where you at? There you at. Cool. Yeah. So if you notice up here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 4, 3, 2. Fun stuff. Any other questions? Yeah, it's at cssjanice.commenter.com. Yes. Not really. Browsers treat XHTML as HTML, unless you send a MIME type that's different, it'll treat it as XML. You're probably in crazy land if you do that, so I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah. Yes, please repeat the question. So the question was about internationalizing your content, get text, and C program. So typically what you end up doing is you store your strings that are to be localizable in some database somewhere, and you separate. It's almost like CSS and content, right? You want to separate these things out, and you want to do it in a way that's, again, as I was alluding to earlier, you don't want to do it in a way that's English dependent, like that it's going to work and make sense in English but not in other languages. It's more the server side stuff. We could talk about that in a second. One more question. So, which editor would I recommend for bidirectional text? I haven't found one that I like. TextMate's pretty good, but it has some weirdness. So I use TextMate on the Mac, and I don't usually run into too many issues, but occasionally I've run into a few, so I haven't really found it. But I'm a Mac guy. There might be something that works totally awesome on Windows, and I just haven't found it yet. So I think that's it. I think we're out of time. So, with 2 minutes? Okay, great. So any more questions? We are done. Fantastic. Yay! Thanks.